We prepare to start this historic session on disability and HIV/AIDS beyond barriers. I would like to take the pleasure of welcoming all of you to this session. Our discourse this afternoon is going to premise mainly on issues of disability and HIV and AIDS. And I'm calling it historical because it is the first time at an international gathering of this nature and at this level that disability issues are getting to the forefront. And with me, I have Maria de Bran, who shall be co-chairing the session, and of course, a panel of speakers who are going to give us different perspectives on the issue of disability and HIV. Maybe before I go further and hand over to Maria, I just want to introduce myself. As you can read the names there, I'm Wesigwa Martin Babu. I work with the National Union of Disabled Persons of Uganda. I'm also a member of the steering committee of the African Decade on Disability and HIV/AIDS. I'm also a member of the Civil Society Interconstituency Coordination Committee in Uganda, and I am a disability activist. So I want to welcome you and say we hope we shall have a very interesting and very interactive session in the next 1 hour and so minutes. Thank you very much. Maria.
Good afternoon. Welcome. And I'm so pleased that you all decided to come to this session. As Martin said, my name is Maria de Bran. I work with an international organization called IPAS that works on women's reproductive rights. Before I came to IPAS, I worked in the Netherlands, and one of the things I did was research on access of people from migrant groups when they were disabled to health services in Amsterdam. We're going to have a very interesting session, and the presenters are going to talk about issues of unsafe sex and chronic mental illness in Brazil, non-medical representations of disability in the context of HIV and AIDS in South Africa, the experiences of female and male deaf adolescents in Cameroon, the inclusion of disabled women in mainstream AIDS service organization work in Uganda. I just want to highlight three things that you will hear that are common in these presentations. One is that unsafe sex is not uncommon, and this is the same as with other population groups. That's something that we must be aware of. Disabled people in both continents, about which our speakers will speak, encounter sexual violence quite often, and this is particularly the case for women. And it's something we must be very conscious about. And the recommendations are to improve safer sex and interventions on information, education, and communication for people living with disabilities so that we reduce their vulnerability. Now, later you will have the chance to engage in a discussion with our presenters. And I just want to give you something to think about while you're listening. And that is, should we be expanding the focus beyond prevention of HIV and STIs to coping with the negative consequences of unsafe sex and violence, because violence is such a problem? And if we talk about that, do we want to integrate measures such as referrals to services for survivors of domestic and sexual violence, referrals to legal aid and human rights organizations, making available post-exposure prophylaxis to people with disabilities, because often they will not know about that, making available emergency contraception and safe abortion for women who suffer unwanted pregnancies as a result of sexual violence, and increased attention to voluntary counseling and testing, and also counseling on sexual and reproductive health. Now I will introduce our first speaker.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Mark Guimarães is a professor of epidemiology at the Federal University of Minas Gerais in Brazil, and he is currently a visiting professor at the HIV Center for Clinical and Behavioral Studies at Columbia University. Mark has worked in AIDS-related research since the late 1980s, and he has a special interest in ARV adherence and risk behavior assessments among HIV-infected populations and others. He is now a principal investigator in a national study of psychiatric patients in Brazil called the Pessoas Project, and his presentation here will describe some of the findings from that project. Please welcome Mark.
Thank you, Maria, for this nice introduction. I'd like to thank the organizer of the AIDS conference for the opportunity to present the results of our project in this special session. I'm going to be talking about a national study that we've been conducting in Brazil among psychiatric patients. And as Maria said, it's called Pessoas Project, or Personas, or People, meaning interaction in connection. There are evidences indicating that psychiatric patients are at increased risk for STDs, AIDS including, and among the factors that influence this risk, we can include clinical conditions, social conditions, and some risk behaviors. In addition, knowledge and prevention factors such as risk perception, knowledge of HIV/AIDS, isolation, segregation can increase that vulnerability. In addition to that, services are not prepared to respond to the needs of psychiatric patients in terms of STIs. Contrary to what many people think, psychiatric patients are sexually active, as you can see here, although they do have high rates of unprotected sex, multiple partnerships, and also sex with other populations at risk, and drug and alcohol use during sex. What happens is that most studies that originate this kind of data are very selected. Usually they are studies on using patients with more severe psychiatric conditions, usually in selected hospitals or outpatient clinics. So the rationale for this study, which is a national study, is this perception of increased vulnerability in higher STI prevalence among mentally ill patients. And the AIDS program in Brazil and the mental health program gathered together to launch this study in order to get more representative data on the prevalence of HIV, hepatitis B, syphilis, in order to develop proper policy and measures in terms of care and prevention for this population. So the general objectives of the Pessoas Project were to determine the prevalence of HIV, syphilis, and hepatitis among psychiatric patients under care in public services, hospitals, or outpatients, and also to describe sociodemographic and behavior and other characteristics. We also did ethnographic studies, focal groups, and an evaluation of all the services participants. But in this presentation, I'm going to focus and explore data comparing gender differences in terms of sexual behavior. This is a complicated slide. It's just to indicate that this project had a very close collaboration between the Brazilian government through both programs, National AIDS Program and the Mental Health Program, the research group, and the services participating. It's a cross-sectional study. The population was composed of psychiatric patients hospitalized in public hospitals or under care in outpatient units called CAPS. We used random procedures in all phases of the sampling scheme. So we're talking about adult patients hospitalized under care And there are two criteria that I should mention here. We excluded those centers which were specialized in substance use treatment in order to avoid overestimating risks. Also, we, because of legal constraints and clinical constraints, we only included patients capable of answering the questionnaires and able to also sign a written informed consent. This is just to show the two sample stages. So first we selected the hospitals and CAPS. So we selected 11 hospitals and 15 CAPS, which are the outpatient clinics. And we selected them in proportion to the type of service, in proportion to the number of AIDS cases by region in Brazil. And as you can see, there is a concentration of services in the southeastern region of Brazil, which is the region with most AIDS cases. About 60% of the cases are concentrated in this area. And then we separated by randomly selected the patients individually in the hospital stratum or in the CAPS stratum. Basically, I'm reporting data on the self-reported lifetime sexual behavior. We understand that lifetime sexual behavior is a better way of looking into the risk, overall risk during their lifetime. We were able to check for reliability of this data. Very rarely we do see reliability assessment of lifetime sexual behavior. Our definition of unsafe was not always used in condoms in all practices. And we basically used logistic regression for analysis. From the total recruited patients, we had 15% that were not capable. That means we have to look into this population at some time. So they had to be excluded because of that. We lost about 10% of our population. And in the end, I'm going to present data on the about 2,400 patients. This is the part of my presentation. Basically, I'm going to highlight the difference between men and women, men in red, women in blue. And what you see here is that men had more hospitalization, psychiatric hospitalizations. They had a higher proportion of homelessness history. More men lived in the hospitals as compared to women. However, more women were married or in union, stable union, and a large proportion, 22% of these women, lived alone, either with children only or with partners only. Men had more hospitalizations, and they had more severe psychiatric diagnosis, as schizophrenia or bipolar disorders. Also, they had more a high proportion of substance use, whereas women had more depression, as diagnosed here. Parallel to that, there were more men with past history of STI. Although we can see here that both men and women had a high proportion of self-perceived medical comorbidity. And about a quarter of both groups had been tested for HIV already. We see here that in all these red variables, these are markers of behavior. Men had more alcohol use, smoking, any illicit drug use, injection, history of incarceration. Also, a high proportion of early sexual initiation and multiple partnership. On the contrary, women had a higher proportion of lifetime unprotected sex. So men had more of the traditional, you know, the behavior risk factors, while women, in fact, had a higher proportion of unprotected sex. Similarly, men had more sex under the influence of drugs or under the influence of alcohol. They offered money for sex more often than women. We should point out here that lifetime sexual violence, which is actually rape, was higher among women, as pointed out by Maria, but also high rates of physical violence and verbal violence. Although the perception of risk, of self-perception of HIV risk, was actually higher among men. And surprisingly, the level of knowledge was good in terms of, we asked 10 questions in terms of yes and wrong and correct, and both groups had a good, but women had a higher proportion of bare knowledge. This is just so this this is the prevalence of HIV overall prevalence in this population. So we found 0.8% of this population were positive for HIV. And what I should comment here is that this is a general representative study of this population in Brazil. So when we compare this data, we have to compare it to other representative studies. And in this case, compared to general study, population study in Salvador, or pregnant women, or military recruits, or pregnant women in other cities, our prevalence was higher. And also, our prevalence was higher than the estimate for the overall adult populations in Brazil. However, what we see here is that younger women in red had higher prevalence of syphilis and HIV, as opposed to older men who had higher prevalence of hepatitis B and C. This is the univariate analysis indicated the risk factors for unprotected sex. What you see here is that for both men and women, most of the variables were significantly associated with unprotected sex, like age, marital status, psychiatric diagnosis, multiple partnership, and several others. Here, we see that living along with children or partners was associated also with, at the univariate analysis, with unprotected sex in both men and women. However, never been tested, had a lower risk, and a low knowledge of HIV also had a lower risk, meaning this is just a marker of perception in this population. History of sexual violence was associated with increased unprotected sex among women, but not among men. So I'm just showing the multivariate analysis for men and women. And what really remained in the two groups, age of the older men or older women had higher risk of unprotected sex. Those married, you can see here the risk was very high, 7 or 9 for both men and women. Having multiple partnership lifetime. Now, sex under alcohol was a risk factor for women, but not for men. Smoking also was a risk factor for women, not for men. Well, history of STD was a risk factor for men, but also for women borderline. The major difference between the two groups we can find here. For men, psychiatric diagnosis was associated with an increased risk of unprotected sex, especially depression, 6-time-folder risk, and anxiety. However, this was not associated among women. And living alone with children or living alone with partners was very significant for women and not for men. So my considerations and conclusions are, this is the first national study sample of mentally ill patients in Brazil or elsewhere, to my knowledge. We may have underestimated some of the prevalences because of the exclusion criteria, but we had to go with those exclusions because of legal procedures and the understanding of the process. So even if we underestimate the prevalence of 0.8, it could be higher than that. And also, it's a cross-sectional sample. Have to be cautioned with regard to causal inference. In conclusions, we have higher STI seroprevalence as compared to other representative populations in Brazil. Younger women showed higher prevalence of syphilis and HIV. We have an extremely high rate of unprotected sex for both men and women. Remember, this is like, I'm talking about 80% of unprotected sex in this population. So whatever analysis we have to carry on here, we must take into account attributable risk, the proportion of those of infections which would be attributed to the unprotected sex. Men tended to have more severe mental illnesses, more hospitalizations, and higher prevalence of risk behaviors as compared to women. However, women tended to practice more unsafe sex, especially those older in married or in stable relationships. Psychiatric diagnoses were associated with risky behaviors among men, while women living alone only with children or partners had a higher risk. Two important messages. First of all, public policies are urgently needed. These services, both hospitals are outpatients. They're not prepared to deal with this situation. Very few of these providers had any sexual education program or distributed condom or any kind of approach for prevention of HIV or STI in this population. So we must increase the number of sites with any sexual education programs, increase condom distribution, increase availability of HIV testing, improve referencing contra-reference between the psychiatric hospitals and the STD or AIDS referral centers, training of personnel, and also very important is this dissemination of our results to society and community diagnosis organizations. Because this was a governmental initiative, both Brazilian programs, AIDS and mental health, are deeply concerned and committed to address the results of Pessoa's project. And we are right now working on a dissemination of the results to all the centers that participated in the project. And we hope we can move on with further exploring some of the questions that in this exploratory study we could raise. This is just to thank our funding agency, which is the National AIDS Program at the UNESCO, our collaborators in Pessoa's project, and all the supervisors there kindly took their effort and time to conduct the studies locally. Thank you very much. Gracias.
Thank you very much, Mark. That was great. No, the questions will come later. Now, what Mark's essentially is saying is that people's psychiatric challenges are sexually active. And that's something we don't agree with. Most of the communities we come from, we don't look at people with mental challenges as people are sexually active. Two, he also goes on to say that women face more sexual violence, women with mental challenges. And that also underpins the fact that women with mental challenges do not have the power or the strength to negotiate safe sex. And that's something that we should think about. I now want to take the pleasure to invite Jill Hannes Hancock. Jill graduated from Humboldt University in Berlin, Germany. She has carried out her work in special education and educational psychology in England, Germany, and South Africa. In the last 3 years, Jill has built an integration project for a local school in Durban. Her fields of expertise include mainstreaming and inclusion, on gender relations, sexual violence, and socio-cultural aspects of HIV/AIDS. Her PhD dissertation was on the notions of disability in the context of HIV and AIDS in KwaZulu-Natal. Jill joined the AIDS Research Organization, Health Economics and HIV/AIDS Research Division in Durban as a postdoc fellow in February 2008. Her current research looks at sexual decision-making by young people in KwaZulu-Natal, and she is also the coordinator, coordinating a research group for the Africa Campaign on HIV/AIDS and Disability. Jill, you're most welcome.
Thank you. The study that I'm going to present today is about the work on my last 4 years, and I would like to take you a little bit back in history there. In 2004, I organized a symposium on HIV/AIDS and disability in Germany, and there was the global survey on HIV/AIDS and disability, as well as a survey from Handicap International introduced. What was very clear on both surveys is that people with disabilities have been left out of the fight against HIV/AIDS. And as a result of that, they had less knowledge on HIV/AIDS, and they had less access to prevention campaigns. Now, although South Africa was not included in those surveys, the representatives there on that same symposium from Disabled People South Africa, Andrew Dube and Emmeline Thiele, made very clear that South Africa is facing a very same problem. And in addition to the access problem, that there's also a problem with the social construction of disability and the gender. Now, as a result of that, I made my way out to South Africa, to the province of KwaZulu-Natal, to investigate what is going on there. And as you can see from that quotation on the screen, when you look into the problem of disability and HIV/AIDS or the connection from the two, you have to look into the access problem, but also you have to look into the social construction of disability and into gender. And that's what I did in my study. So besides being part of the disability movement in South Africa in the last 4 years, my study was informed by 25 in-depth interviews. The participants of that study were quite diverse. What they had in common is they could all in one way or the other reflect about disability because they were either disabled people themselves, they were their caretakers, teachers, family members, occupational therapists, or traditional healers. The study used theoretical and snowball sampling, and for the analysis of the interviews, I used open Excel and serial recording. All of it was supported by the computer program MaxQDA, which is, if you don't know it, it's similar to InVivo. At the end of my study, I discussed my results with DPSA, I repeat, as Disabled People South Africa, to see if what I found mirrors what they reflect about. Now, to come to the results, it did show that the disability grant that is available in South Africa is very helpful for people with disability to basically lift them out of poverty. Then other results that I had, they confirm what other studies have already said, that the access to health institutions is difficult for people with disabilities simply because there isn't a ramp, there isn't a sign interpreter, there isn't Braille. So the same applies for schools. In South Africa, we're lucky that we have an inclusive policy which in theory should enable pupils like children with disability to access mainstream schools. However, having a policy and the reality is not necessarily the same, again, because of the same, you don't have a ramp, you don't have a sign interpreter and so on. So there, as a result, there are long waiting lists for in special schools and the education of people with disability is delayed. When it comes to textile education, then similar to other studies, we found that there's either no sexual education or that the education that is there is not disability specific, which particularly applies for pupils with mental disability. The same applies for VCT and ARV, which are basically sometimes not accessible for the same reasons. And what also my study showed that there's very, very little support in cases of sexual abuse. I will say something to that later. When we talk now about the social construction of disability, it becomes a little bit more complicated because we have to inquire into Zulu cosmology. Now, Zulu-speaking people explain disability with either being caused through naturally or through the influence of supernatural powers. And I can only make two examples here. For instance, if a mother gives birth to a disabled child, it is possible that the father's family or the father himself is refusing that child on the basis of what we call in Zulu ufuzo, which means that this belief that certain disabilities are only running in certain families, which means that the father's family says, no, we don't have that type of disability in our family, so you must have this from a disabled man, go away. This, of course, exposes the mother and the child particular to vulnerability. Now, on the other side, disability can also be explained with the influences of supernatural powers like witchcraft, for instance, or the influence a curse through God. Now, if disability is explained to the influence of witchcraft, then health-seeking behavior can be relayed. If it is explained through a curse of God, then that person will be excluded from society. Now, besides these two main categories, there's also the concept of vulnerability and protection. Zulu-speaking people believe that you can protect yourself from any type of misfortune from which disability is one through ritual cleansing and through worshipping your ancestors. In return, that means that if you're in contact with pollution or if you don't worship your ancestors well enough, you are very vulnerable to either of the two courses of misfortune. In this case, I'm talking about disabilities.
Now, in the context of HIV/AIDS and disability, this has taken quite a complicated form. Because this concept of vulnerability and protection also implies that you can cleanse yourself from a particular misfortune. Now, there is a belief in South Africa that you can cleanse yourself from HIV through sleeping with a virgin. Now, the combination of that that interpretation with the combination of the belief that people with disability are asexual has made, in here particular, women vulnerable to sexual abuse. Now, there are two. The vulnerability of people with disability to sexual abuse can either be caused through what I just explained, but it can also be that people with disability are seen as sexual overactive. You might find that is contradicting, but it depends on who is interpreting what. Now, if people with disabilities are seen as sexual overactive, funny enough, the same thing happens. They've been taken advantage of, and they're also being sexually exploited. Now, what I want to say is that all of that what I have described particularly applies for women and girls with disability. And that is not surprising because we're living in a society where gender imbalance is more the norm than the exception, and where sexual violence has been epidemic in South Africa. So if you look back at the triangle that I showed you at the beginning, you will find that women and girls with disability are actually triple marginalized. Once, because they're living in a country where they have little access to resources, to prevention, to treatment. Once, because they're stigmatized because of their disability. And the third time, because they are women or girls. Now, the consequences, I just want to sum them up with a couple of quotations, are that there is very little sexual education for people with disability, often because the teachers say they don't want to wake sleeping dogs. There is very little access to prevention and treatment because teachers as well as nurses don't feel they are in the position to deal with those people. There is sexual exploitation, and here I must maybe say it's not only outside of relationships, it also happens inside relationships when there is an imbalance. Like that example that I give here from a deaf woman that basically slept with her husband or boyfriend without a condom because that's what he was demanding. And because she was in such a low position in that relationship, she had to do whatever he said. I've already explained the sexual abuse problem, and one of the problems that we also have in that connection is there's very little legal protection, which can mean that if a person decides to actually go to the police and report the sexual abuse, then the police officers are not trained to deal with that particular person. Now, what can happen, I've got a case in my study, is that the deaf woman did report it or tried to report a rape to the police station, and the police officer misinterpreted her signing and raped that particular woman at the police station. So we can see the need here for some kind of training of police officer, and that goes all the way through to attorneys that don't know how to deal with the people to the judge. Now, the people with disability and their caretakers are reacting to that problem quite differently. Some of them deny it completely. They say, as I already quoted, if you don't wake sleeping dogs, you separate girls and boys in schools, then nothing will happen. Other ones have just a laissez-faire approach and say, you know what, if a person with disability is raped, she or he can be lucky. Who else would take them? They had at least one time sex. Now, what is interesting is a group of people, and that are people particular and disabled people in South Africa, that have organized themselves and they have a very strong advocacy for disability and HIV/AIDS within South Africa. And they are probably the group to look at that are very interesting for us. What they basically have done since 2004, they had a conference, they have gone up to the national level, and they have made themselves heard. It's the South African National AIDS Council. So in that council, their disability is already a sector, I think, which is quite a success. And that is because of civil society that has been informed by research or supported by research. Now, maybe interesting for other countries, I just want to mention here some initiatives that, because I now have to go away from KwaZulu-Natal to show you what, how this goes through the district level to the national level. What South Africa has achieved this year, or I would say not South Africa, the disability movement, is that through being a sector in the National AIDS Council, there has been a report published in May 2008, on why people with disability in all the different categories of disability are particularly vulnerable and what possible responses are. Now, in addition to that, and I hope it's really going to happen, but I have seen the research papers for that, there will be three fully accessible hospitals launched in South Africa that try to model of how can you make treatment and prevention accessible for people with disabilities. Now, I'm of the opinion that there are a lot of other projects out there that are already working and from which we could do a lot of South-South learning. And I've just mentioned here a couple that are available in South Africa. For instance, there is a very good manual by Rebecca Jones that looks into how to teach children with intellectual disabilities about HIV/AIDS and sexuality. Then there is a program that is in Cape Town, the Cape Mental Health. They are an intervention program that assists people with disability during rape cases, which I think is something we really, really do need to look at. Unfortunately, there hasn't been funding so far to get this particular very successful project to other provinces like, for instance, KwaZulu-Natal. And then I would like to mention that the CBR, which is the community-based rehabilitation, is a very good model to fight against misconception about disability as well as getting people with disability out of the houses and visible in the public. Unfortunately, also something that has been underfunded. And I'm personally of the opinion that home-based care could learn a lot from community-based rehabilitation because that model has already 20 years of experience and is actually doing what home-based care is supposed to do. Now, as my last slide, I just want to show that this slide from the African campaign, which I joined together with Martin, just to show you which are the countries in Africa that already included disability in their national strategic plan. And I hope we meet in 2 years again, and I hope this whole map is going to be read. And we have got a lot of more projects of good practice that have been evaluated that we can share, because I think that is really what is needed. Yeah, with this I say thank you and gratias. And I really want to invite everyone to join the African Campaign on HIV/AIDS and Disability. They got a website. Then also, I really would like to invite you to look at the HERT website from Health Economics and HIV/AIDS Research Division. Under my name, you will find a full systematic literature review on HIV/AIDS and disability. And you can basically look for what country you need knowledge, and you will probably very likely find a survey that you don't know about. And there will be a short description for you to access that. Also, like where you can access this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jill. That was a very enlightening presentation. And I think you illustrated so well that it's really important for us to understand the cultural context, but also look at issues through a gender lens. And I hope that people will be willing to contact you and that there will be a lot more sharing among people working in this field as she is calling for. Now, our next speaker has been very modest in providing information about herself. I can't give you quite as long an introduction as for other people. But Dr. Claudia Bisol is a professor of psychology at the Universidade de Caxias do Sul in Brazil. She also has a private practice. Claudia has worked in the field of disability and deafness for 10 years. And she has especially been working with deaf children and adolescents. Claudia was a Fogarty International trainee with the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. And another interesting fact is that she not only works with deaf children, but she's an author of children's books. Please welcome Claudia.
Thank you very much, Maria. I'd like to start by thanking the organizing committee of this conference for the opportunity of being here, and to thank also the chairs of this session for the organization and also my colleagues. I'm going to talk about a study entitled HIV/AIDS Knowledge and Health-Related Behaviors, a Hearing versus Deaf, or a Boy versus Girl issue. There are a few issues that I'd like you to keep in mind. The first of them is that deaf adolescents face all developmental tasks that characterize adolescence, but at the same time, they must deal with hearing impairment and its consequences in terms of communication, education, health access, and work opportunities. So these are a few extra challenges that they have to deal with. Literature regarding deaf youths usually reports insufficient knowledge and understanding of HIV/AIDS, and that they are at greater risk of HIV infection compared to hearing youths. So this study was developed with the objective of describing HIV/AIDS knowledge and health-related attitudes and behaviors among deaf and hearing adolescents in the south of Brazil. It was developed in the city of Caxias do Sul. It's close to Porto Alegre. It's the southernmost state of Brazil, not far from Argentina and Uruguay. Deaf and hearing students volunteered to answer a computer-assisted questionnaire. We used the CASI system in the computer laboratory of the University of Caxias do Sul. Before they did that, this questionnaire was improved to focus groups discussions that were developed with both deaf and hearing adolescents in a qualitative study. And it was adapted. So it had simultaneous video translation of questions to Brazilian Sign Language provided by a deaf woman and a deaf man, both fluent sign language speakers. And it had a branched decision tree structure that considers students' level of sexual experience and hearing status. The closed questions were analyzed using SPSS. There were open-ended questions, but these are not the focus of this presentation here. This is the interface of the questionnaire. So this is what students first could see in the screen of their computers. Each one had, of course, one computer for himself or herself. And then all they had to do, the deaf students, was to press this button here, so this window would pop out with the questions being read in a Brazilian Sign Language and also the alternatives for the answers. And they could play it as many times as they wished. They could skip the question if they didn't want to answer, they didn't feel comfortable enough to answer, and so on. So we had 50 hearing students participating and 42 deaf students. The mean age is quite similar, but notice that the standard deviation is higher for the deaf, so this is a much more heterogeneous group. The hearing students attended a regular public school, and the deaf attended a non-residential special public school for the deaf, both schools located in the same neighborhood of the city. Some of the results. We knew already that HIV/AIDS knowledge was the level of knowledge was smaller in the deaf community, and this is what we saw in our group too. So you can see here the hearing and the deaf. When we compare boys and girls, we see no difference at all. School education was also expected, but we found that 62% of the deaf were still in elementary school, while 100% of the hearing were in secondary school. In terms of health-related attitudes and behaviors, no relevant differences were found for number of sexual partners in the last 12 months, condom use when have sex, condom use the last time they had sex. And this is interesting information. You can see here that when we compare them for being married or live with a partner, have a boyfriend or girlfriend or a partner, date without commitment, or do not have a boyfriend or girlfriend or any casual relationships at the moment. This is the yellow here. It's quite similar. What is said, we were expecting a number, a high number for this one, but even so, it's sad to find out, is that we found a high rate of sexual abuse among the deaf youths. We found 31%. When we compared boys and girls, we saw that boys were more sexually active than girls. Girls discussed sexual issues more frequently with their mothers than boys did. And father did not show up either for boys or girls. It was like they don't talk with their fathers. They talk with their mothers when they do. And girls visited gynecologists more than boys visited urologists. Alcohol consumption did not differ among boys and girls, but boys smoked more than girls and boys used more drugs than girls did. So a few, sexual debut and partnership, we found no different, significant differences for either hearing versus deaf or boy versus girl. Girls, although hearing students reported being more sexually active than the deaf. Some of our conclusions then. Lower levels of HIV/AIDS knowledge and of school education and the high rates of reported sexual abuse among the deaf demonstrate the need to improve school-based instruction for this group, tailor health education to deaf adolescents' communication needs, and improve protection against sexual violence. But the similarities found in terms of behavior, when deaf adolescents were compared to hearing adolescents, they questioned the common sense views of deaf individuals as socially inadequate or sexually immature, and they also questioned the excessive emphasis placed on knowledge for the promotion of behavior change. Results obtained when boys and girls are compared indicated even within the deaf community, youths are a heterogeneous group, affected by several social determinants that must be considered when promoting health-related attitudes and behaviors for preventing HIV/AIDS. So it's not talk only about being deaf or hearing, it's also about being a boy and a girl, being Brazilian or Mexican or American, religious or not, heterosexual or homosexual, even within the deaf community. And so these cultural issues must be addressed. I want to acknowledge Fogarty AITRP grant, also the National Council of Technological and Scientific Development of Brazil, CNPq, and HIV/AIDS Research Laboratory at the University of Caxias do Sul. Without this support, this study would not be possible. And I would like to thank you all for your kind attention. Thank you very much. Oh, and I'd like to invite you. We're going to have a skills building workshop named Reaching Deaf Communities. It's going to be tomorrow at 2:30 at special buildings, the skills buildings room number 7. So I wish I can see you there tomorrow. Thank you.
Dr. Claudia, that was beautiful. I couldn't have said or acknowledged any better than that. But of course, what comes out of that is that we must acknowledge the humanness of persons with disability. Because sometimes when we see disabled persons, what we see first clouds our perceptions. He's disabled, he's deaf, he has mental challenges. Therefore, there is no need to focus them in our HIV/AIDS programming. I want to take the honor now to introduce the next speaker, Mr. Adonis Toko. Adonis is a psychosociologist, and he graduated from the University of Yaoundé in Cameroon and Bordeaux in France. For the first 15 years, he has worked on behavioral sciences research with particular interest in the sexual and reproductive health of mobile populations. Most especially, he has also worked with the deaf and the hearing impaired and teenage mothers. Since 2005, Adonis has been conducting the first Cameroonian program on HIV and AIDS among the deaf people, and this is called Deaf Against AIDS. He now heads the Behavioral Sciences Research Institution based in Yaoundé called the Cameroon Psychology Forum. Adonis, you're most welcome.
Thank you, Mr. President. I should also add my voice to thank the organizer of this conference. Ladies and gentlemen, as the President has said, our presentation will be about a neglected group in the fight against HIV/AIDS, sexual behavior and HIV prevalence among the young deaf population in Cameroon. Let's consider the general context of this study. As a social minority, disabled appear to be economically and socially marginalized and object of various kinds of faith beliefs. People usually consider them as being sexually inactive or less active and therefore less exposed to risky sexual behavior and HIV infection. So is the case of deaf and hearing impaired that are often perceived as easy prey and therefore used as objects for sexual pleasure, with several implications in terms of sexual abuse, rape, STI, and HIV/AIDS. Furthermore, there are poor economic conditions and psychological status with inferiority complex, exaggerated factors to act as exacerbating factors to this situation and make them more vulnerable to risks, sexual risk. Resulting from such a critical defect, a very little information is available about their sexual behavior and also on the prevalence of HIV within this subgroup. So as a first analytic step to master this situation, a serobehavioral study was conducted in Cameroon so as to fill the gap of information noticed here and also elsewhere in Africa. Ladies and gentlemen, this is just to show you the location of the study. This is Africa, this is Cameroon, and this is Yaoundé, where we have actually conducted this study. Our objective was to describe sexual behavior, evaluate risk factors, and determine HIV prevalence among the deaf in Yaoundé, Yaoundé in Cameroon. So as for methodology, this was a cross-sectional quantitative study using a standardized pre-coded questionnaire with deaf population, male and female, age 15 to 34. We use as fieldwork personnel teachers of deaf who master both spoken and sign languages, who are actually invited to train young people who were used as surveyors. Methodology. The town of Yaoundé was classified according to subdivisions, and the members of deaf association were actually invited to locate target person in the different subdivision. And after location of any targeted person, this person was invited to show us where are the others, and the interview were conducted on the spot. As for HIV screening tests, at the end of the interview, we gave a ticket to every person to offer a free HIV screening SSI in a VCT in the neighbor area. And the sera were diagnosed using a rapid or a confirmation test, depending of the cases. We used APM4 and SPSSS to analyze our data. And we should also mention some problems that we faced. First, the communication between hearing person and deaf, but also attempts between deaf people themselves. There was also a problem of very low literacy level between deaf people, attempts even illiteracy. We also noticed that we needed very long time to be able to pass the information. Also, we needed breaks during the interviews, because usually the longer you talk with these young people, without any break, the lower they register what you are saying. And we should also mention the fact that a low screening test acceptance was noticed due to lack of confidentiality. Let's have a view on sociodemographic characteristics. 126 deaf people aged 15 to 34 were interviewed. 52% were male and 47% female. Average age was 24, with 97 of them bachelors, and then 80.2 have already had a sexual intercourse. The average age for the first sexual act was 17 for boys and 16 for girls, as compared to 18 and 16.7 in the general population, as we can notice in the latest DHS study in Cameroon. 60% did not complete primary school, so we talk of very less lower literacy level. 30% had no occupation, and almost all the rest were engaged in small occupation, with a kind of clear social division of labor between boys and girls. Let's consider the result. First, the behavioral component of the study. As for multi-partnership, for the last 12 months, multi-sexual partnership occur in 45% of cases for general partners. For regular partners, more in boys' subgroup than in girls' subgroup, and 30% of cases for casual partners, also with a significant gender difference between boys and girls. We should say that these figures are lower in the general population of the same age group, if you consider the latest result of a DHS. Let's consider condom use and risky sexual behavior. 86% of respondents, so they are sexually active, have already used a condom, mainly to prevent HIV. But for the last sexual act, 47% of people did not protect this act. For those who use condom during the last sexual intercourse, boys show more self-efficiency in proposing condom than girls, as we can notice in these figures. Actually, the DHS results show that 57% of boys and 46% of girls did not protect their sexual risky behavior, so we can make a comparison. Let's consider sex for gain and STIs. First of all, 44% of girls have received money or present, while 56% of boys have given money or any kind of present in exchange for sex during the last 12 months. Average amount received was about CFA 500, which is a little bit $1 or more. And the present giving did not usually exceed small items like a bottle of beer, roasted fish, and etc. As considered STI, the concept of STI was known only by 50% of all respondents, with no gender difference noticed, and the STI episodes were reported at least once on 20% of interviews with a gender difference. This is evidence of more risky sexual behavior within the deaf as compared to the DHS results, as we can see here. For the DHS results, we only have 6.4% of men and 4.5% for women for the same period of time. Knowledge of AIDS and prevention methods. Virtually all respondents have heard about AIDS, but some of them were still doubtful or skeptical about the reality of this disease. For preferred methods of HIV prevention, use of condom comes first, then confidence, and sexual abstinence. And also, we notice that boys appear as those who less believe in abstinence as compared to girls. Now, let us consider the serology component of this study. We found it very difficult to have informed consent because of communication barrier and also lack of confidentiality. Fixed strategy in VCT was used as first attempt, and the outreach strategy was also used where this fixed strategy did not work. Mobilization of deaf peers were instrumental in gaining the confidence of other deaf, especially for the reticent of them. 101 deaf accepted to go in for the voluntary HIV screening test, that is 56% of boys and 44% of girls. Results show 4 positive cases, that is 3 girls and 1 boy, which gave us a 4% prevalence rate. We should notice that this is close to the national seroprevalence average, which actually is considered to be 5.5%. So what can we conclude? One, we should now consider that it is evident that the deaf are not sexually inactive as perceived by the general population, the public. Sexual risk indicator may be at times higher in this group as compared to the general population, and we have noticed it. Secondly, girls appear more vulnerable than boys in terms of HIV infection. This gender differential looks more pronounced between deaf boys and deaf girls than between boys and girls in the general population. HIV infection may be gradually increasing in the deaf population of Yaoundé, Cameroon. Since a first screening test conducted 2 years ago in a deaf school in Yaoundé gave us only one girl, one positive person, which was a girl. Third, intensification of HIV AIDS prevention campaign and care targeting this minority should now become a priority with adapted actions. And we should also notice that such programs should include items to develop positive self-esteem and individual or intergroup economic capacities. So this is a picture just to make you understand that the study was carried out in the framework of a program called Deaf Against AIDS, which actually enabled us to mobilize and to train a good number of deaf young people, as you can see in this picture. The project was made possible thanks to a grant from Global Fund to CARE Cameroon. And we also have here some leaflets about the project if you want to have more information about this. Thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you very much for that presentation. And one of the things that struck me again was the gender disparity in the outcome. And the picture at the end made me think, wouldn't it be fantastic if in 2 years at the next AIDS conference, we actually have one of the deaf young people presenting on their own project to deal with something like this? I really hope that's something that we can all be working towards, having people from these communities also representing on their own behalf. Now I would like to introduce our last speaker, but certainly not least. She is going to be continuing to sit here at the table. It is Miroslava Tatarin, and she works as an advisor on disability and AIDS for AIDS Free World, a new international AIDS advocacy organization co-founded by Paula Donovan and Stephen Lewis. Miroslava is the recipient of an honors BA in Development Studies and Environment Studies from Queen's University in Canada. And she has since been active in promoting the inclusion of people with disabilities in worldwide AIDS advocacy efforts. It's an issue to which she was drawn through her personal experience with disability and her work with the disabled people's organizations in Canada, Ghana, the Ukraine, South Africa, and Uganda. Miroslava was instrumental in the development of both national education strategy and a training manual on disability and HIV/AIDS for disabled people in South Africa. And she has been invited to speak about building alliances between the AIDS and the disability rights movement at several international gatherings. She has published papers including Attitudes That Don't Work, Women with Disabilities and Employment, and a youth perspective on the sixth session of the Ad Hoc Committee for an International Convention for the Protection and the Promotion of the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Please welcome Miroslava.
Thank you and good afternoon. We at AIDS Free World would like to bring to light the need for a comprehensive and sustainable response to the needs of persons with disabilities by the international AIDS community. There are excellent creative innovations taking place on the ground, but we do need a coordinated global response to support these initiatives and allow them to grow. We applaud that for the first time, this international AIDS conference has included disability issues into its formal program, but we have yet to see the coordinated integration of persons with disabilities and disability issues into UNAIDS, the IAS, and other high-level international structures. First of all, let me take a moment to briefly outline some of the particular concerns of women with disabilities in the face of HIV and AIDS. We are being excluded from HIV/AIDS education initiatives and clinical services. There are widespread ideas that somehow, because we have a disability, we don't fall in love, that we can't find a partner, and that there is no way that we could have sex. Needless to say, these are erroneous misperceptions. Not only are women with disabilities sexually active, we are also often at a much higher risk of sexual abuse from caregivers, partners, and strangers who may see us as defenseless. Even if such report is reported, most often the reports aren't taken seriously. Worse still, there's the idea that we should just be grateful for whatever sex we can get. I think you can see how these issues closely intertwine with HIV risk factors. Gender inequality is not only driving the feminization of the AIDS pandemic, but also leaving women and girls with disabilities more vulnerable to and more affected by physical and mental disabilities. Women and girls currently comprise 74% of persons with disabilities in low and middle income countries, yet they only receive 20% of rehabilitation assistance worldwide. The UN reports that the combination of male preference in many countries and the universal devaluation of disability can be deadly for disabled females. Women with disabilities are less likely to be educated and employed than their male counterparts and are less likely to access and receive medical care. Disabled women's exclusion from healthcare services is rampant worldwide and is not only a question of having wheelchair ramps and braille. Perhaps one of the most painful forms of this discrimination comes in the form of prejudices held by healthcare workers. Imagine for a moment that I am pregnant and going to access prenatal healthcare services for the first time. I have a loving and caring partner, and we are overjoyed by my pregnancy. But when I reach the clinic, I am met with only disdain and pity from the nursing staff. Shame, they say. Sorry, she's disabled herself, and now this. They whisper behind my back, and even worse, they may say, oh, to think that someone could do this to her in her condition. With these degrading attitudes, we begin to see how easy it is for a young disabled woman to lose confidence in her local healthcare providers and to be discouraged from returning. But I digress. There are many, many challenges that we face, but there are also numerous examples of exciting programs sprouting up that bring together people with disabilities and AIDS activists and service providers to combat stigma and make services more accessible to all. Let me share with you three examples of initiatives currently being implemented in East Africa, where I've spent the bulk of my time this year with my colleague, Shanali Shom, who is also in the audience today. These examples illustrate the creativity and the vast potential of partnerships between AIDS service organizations and groups of people with disabilities. My first example comes from Gulu District in northern Uganda. The violent conflict and subsequent displacement that has ravaged Gulu and surrounding districts for the past 20 years corresponds with increased rates of physical impairments as well as higher HIV infection rates. Within this context, a small and courageous group of women with disabilities who are also living with HIV came together following an AIDS and Disability Media Awareness Campaign in 2007, sponsored by the National Union of Disabled Persons in Uganda. Actually, this event was coordinated by our chairperson today, Mr. Martin Babu. In any case, after attending the event, a handful of women with different disabilities gathered the courage to openly disclose their HIV-positive status. In less than 2 years, the group now has more than 45 members. Although the group has yet to receive funding, its members support each other and gather to discuss drug side effects, challenges at home, and even to informally counsel each other's family members. My second example takes us to the urban slum area of Kamocha in Uganda's capital city, Kampala. This is the home of an impressive mental health clinic and community mental health program that was launched in October 2004 by the Kamocha Christian Caring Communities. It's a faith-based organization with more than 20 years of experience providing the Kamocha community with accessible HIV/AIDS testing, treatment, and care services. people with mental health and psychiatric conditions and developmental disabilities continue to be grossly neglected both by the AIDS sector and the disability movement. Kamocha Christian Caring Community's inclusion of mental health under the umbrella of all their programs is a model that can be replicated by other organizations. This structure allows patients to benefit from a range of services available in other KCCC programs, such as educational support for at-risk youth and support for income-generating activities. It makes it easier to refer patients to other services and easier for the patients to access all the services they need in one place. The mental health clinic is now well known and has become an entry point for some patients to then access other KCC services. To date, 219 cases have been referred from the mental health clinic to the main clinic providing HIV/AIDS services. My third and final example is the disability program at Liverpool VCT Care and Treatment in Kenya. Their project coordinator, Washington Opio, is also at this conference, and he will be presenting at a skills building workshop tomorrow afternoon, and also at the AIDS Free World and Disabled People's International Satellite Session that will be held tomorrow evening at 6:30 in Session Room 6. Liverpool's disability program is currently run entirely by deaf counseling and administrative staff, and it runs mobile and standalone clinics in Nairobi, Mombasa, and Kisumu. Liverpool's mainstream structure, the comprehensive nature of this initiative and the way that these initiatives are embedded into the mainstream structure makes it an exemplary program. Deaf project staff are well integrated into the established comprehensive structures of Liverpool's main VCT care and treatment services, and the mainstream staff's exposure to the disability program helps to combat stigma at a systemic level. The disability program does not discriminate against hearing people. Hearing clients attending the clinic work through an interpreter, thereby inverting the norm of having deaf clients always be the ones needing to rely on an interpreter. This also contributes to the dismantling the widespread ignorance and misunderstanding of the deaf community. The integrated nature of the Liverpool Disability Program supports people with disabilities as they tackle HIV/AIDS issues and also helps to reduce stigma both amongst healthcare workers and the broader community. Liverpool Disability Program encourages the replication of its model internationally, and staff are willing to share their experiences with other service providers and disabled people's organizations who are trying to bridge the gap between VCT services and the deaf and people with disabilities. The success of such initiatives and exchanges are, however, largely dependent on international support, both in terms of policy and finances. So this takes us back to my original call for an integrated global response to the needs of people with disabilities in the face of the AIDS pandemic. And this response must be one that stays true to the disability movement's call of nothing about us without us. So I'm grateful for your attention this afternoon. And before I close, I will leave you with a few recommendations for including people with disabilities into your programs as we work towards building this global response. If you are an implementer at a community level or a national level, partner with disabled people's organizations to ensure that the perspective of people with disabilities is included in all aspects of your programming. If you are a funder, make consideration of disability issues a required condition for all the proposals that you solicit. If you are in government, ratify the Convention of the Rights of Persons with Disabilities and the Optional Protocol and ensure that national legislation addresses the rights of people with disabilities and incorporates the principles of the Convention. If you work in the UN, include disability as a vulnerable group in annual reports and monitor the ongoing challenges people with disabilities face in accessing HIV/AIDS prevention and treatment. And these are only a few ideas. If you would like more, please do not hesitate to get in touch. Thank you.
I think that was very breathtaking. Could we say that was a presentation or a press statement? But Tatarin, thank you. She needs a bigger clap than that. I just want to announce how we proceed from here. We want to take a few questions at a time, maybe two, three questions, and then our panel will respond to them. So if you have any questions, please just get behind the mic and fire away. Thank you very much. Please, your names, where you're from. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Simea Moll. I'm from University of Cape Town School of Public Health in South Africa. My question is directed at Dr. Bissell and Dr. Tuco. I've seen the two presentations at a very appropriate time because I'm in the process of developing a PhD protocol on deafness in adolescents in South Africa. And I'd be very interested to know what the experience was, particularly at the fieldwork level, of actually having deaf people fill out the questionnaires. What were the quality of the questionnaires like? What were the hindrances? What were the challenges? If you could just clarify a bit. Thanks very much.
Yeah, next.
Hi, I'm Jody Kajal, and I work for CARE. And in a previous life, I worked for Violence Against Women with Disabilities, a prevention project in California. And I thought this panel was just fantastic, and it's amazing to me how parallel all the issues are across the world in every community. So I had two questions. One of the challenges we had when integrating violence against women with disabilities or disabilities into violence prevention projects was the cost and of interpreters and the limit of interpreters, and that a lot of the interpreters had been pulled to private causes because that's where the money was. So that was the first question. The second question was one of the things that when I first entered the community was one of the bigger challenges was actually divides within the disability community and between deaf and physical and cognitive and mental. And so when we were working with violence prevention agencies and trying to explain access for people with disabilities, it almost was overwhelming to them when they said, well, you know, what about all these disabilities? And the disability community had its own conflicts. So I'm wondering if you all have seen that in some of the work you do, and if you could just speak to that, and thank you.
Hey, my name is Yetna Bershman. I'm from Ethiopia. The question I will be posing will be actually cross-cutting for everyone. On the presentations that were made by most of you, I have tried to see that the person with disabilities are getting more infected with HIV/AIDS and, like, this sort of things. What about the impact of HIV/AIDS having a disability, being a cause of disability? For those who are working with hearing impairment, how did you see, HIV/AIDS being a cause for hearing impairment? How did you see, in the case of psychiatric challenge, how did you see the HIV/AIDS being a cause for psychiatric instead of only focusing on those who have already have acquired psychiatric challenge and then their risk towards HIV/AIDS? How do you see reciprocally the HIV/AIDS being a cause for disability? That's the current threat for everyone, and I think that will be a common point to meet both the HIV/AIDS and the disability world at the same platform. Thank you.
Yeah, next. Let's take the last one, and then we have answers, and then continue.
My name is Palisa Mputle from Lesotho. My question will be on mental retardation and HIV. I would like to know from the speaker from Brazil whether there is any research or any information related to mental retardation and HIV, because I heard him talking about mental illness and HIV. More often you'll find that, maybe it happens in my country only, where you'll find that information or services for disabled. If you go to the services for disabled, they will say, okay, for the people who have mental retardation, this is a mental health case. When you go to the mental health, you'll find that the concentration is more on men, for those who are mentally ill, not who have mental retardation. So it's like they don't have anywhere to go for services in terms of information related to HIV and so on. Another question is about mental retardation and orphanhood. You do find that children with who are orphaned, but and at the same time heavy mental retardation, in my country they end up in streets because in my country we don't have institutions for disabled. And in this era of HIV, you'll find that relatives and even neighbors are reluctant to take them in after they lost their parents. Therefore, they end up in the street and they become even more vulnerable. So I'm wondering what other countries do when it comes to mental retardation and orphanhood.
And finally?
Yes.
Thank you. So let's have the last question and then we continue. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Will. I'm an occupational therapist working in London. My question is actually quite similar to my friend over here from Ethiopia. I work in a country which has had access to antiretrovirals for a really long time. We've heard a lot here to this conference about upscaling over the last few years and over the next few years to lots and lots of countries where we're going to see a lot of people on antiretrovirals, which will mean we'll have a lot of people who will live through illnesses that they previously didn't, but with a level of impairment. There's a study in Canada a year or two ago that showed that 80% of people living with HIV on antiretrovirals had some level of impairment. And certainly in the clinic I work in, we have a lot of people with visual impairments, physical impairments, sensory impairments, cognitive impairments, people who identify themselves as being disabled because of their HIV. My question to the panel is, do you think that countries where we're having treatment upscaling are in any way prepared for the services that people with disabilities because of their HIV will be facing? Will there be those services there?
Great, thank you very much. Now back to the panel. The questions are coming in. Is there a relationship between disability and HIV/AIDS? Is there the cause and effect of each or the other? So we're going to start in this order. Dr. Mark, Jill, Dr. Claudia, Adonis, and Miroslava, my sister. So please, we have a short time. Just get to the point.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm going to be very brief. HIV is a cause of a lot of neurological diseases that may be interacting with psychiatric conditions. The same problem that we saw in psychiatric hospitals in terms of care, I think psychiatric professionals are not prepared to deal with STIs, HIV prevention. We also see that AIDS referral centers are not prepared to deal with psychiatric conditions. So in our attempt to integrate, we must really see the two sides, train both types of providers in terms of care for both patients. As I said, in our project, because of ethical considerations, first of all, our sample was composed of users of service. So they came to hospitals or outpatient clinics. So patients with severe mental retardation had to be excluded for ethical reasons. And because of their capacity of understanding the project in this. This was a national project, so you couldn't really, it was an overall sample. So that portion which represents 15, not only mental retardation, 15%, we need to address this population. In a different project. And I'm not aware of any specific, not nationally, definitely there is no project specifically with mental retardation, not in psychiatric hospitals. I'm not aware of any studies on that in terms of HIV and behavior in Brazil. If there is any other Brazilian here that could say that, I'm not really aware of with mental retardation in general, not only psychiatric.
Thank you, Doctor.
Here? Okay, I will just quickly answer the question with the costs. I think in the disability sector, you will probably be aware of that there's always a problem of underfunding, particularly when it comes to developing countries. And because you mentioned that with sign interpreters and in the context of sexual abuse, that project that I mentioned from the Cape Mental Health is exactly an example of that, where a good project is funded but can't be extended because there is no money for it. At the end of the day, a service costs money. And I think that is something where everyone is asked to advocate that such projects can be taken somewhere else. It needs money. So you have to argue from a human rights perspective there, I think. There's nothing else to say about it. So then there was a question with the unity of the disability movement. And I can just confirm that that is a very big problem. There's even a hierarchy. Usually the people with intellectual disability are at the bottom and they're deaf or the blind at the top. I can, just from the South African experience, I can say when people of all types of disabilities, their caretakers, their teachers and so on, unify, like disabled people South Africa has done, then they can achieve a lot as a civil society movement, as I think the South African example does show. South Africa is in no way an example for HIV and or in implementations in general, but when it comes to disability, funny enough, we the first country to actually do something. So in the developing world, and that is because of the disability movement, because of disabled people themselves advocating for themselves as a unit. So I think that shows maybe that that is needed. Then there was a question about HIV/AIDS as a cause of disability. I think the global survey when that first came out, had pressed the point that there was at the time research on it, on HIV causing disability, but not the other way around. And I think that's why you have seen in the last 4 years research on the other way around. However, yesterday in the school building's workshop on disability and HIV/AIDS, there was a very interesting presentation on exactly that. And if you come afterwards, I'll give you the contact details of that person. Then there was a question about mental retardation and I would prefer to say intellectual disability or learning disability and orphans. And I can just say that there is absolutely no research on it, and I think there are very, very few projects. So certainly there is something to be done. And I personally would recommend, because the urgency is there, I would recommend that we don't start with research that tells us again there is a problem. I would recommend we starting with research that actually is applied, that maybe looks at a project of good practice, or maybe even research that helps implementing or building a project. So, yeah, that is it.
Thank you for the questions addressed to the issues of the deaf adolescents. As for the questionnaires, or any
Dr. Claudia, please, just make it very short. I think we are running out of time. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. Yes, assessing deaf is an issue. please talk to me after the session, and I will refer to some of the work I've published on that, and that might help you. You have to have interpreters for the questionnaires. It cannot be based on the literacy levels because they might not understand what you mean. So talk to me after, those who are interested, after the conference, okay, after the session. And as for the cost of interpreters, they are high in very many contexts. So we are thinking about working with multipliers, work with deaf community, teach them and ask them to teach their partners. That might work as well. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I think she has already mentioned what I wanted to say. You have some tips that you can use to be able to master or to lower the communication barrier between yourself and the deaf population. So at times you introduce breaks when you are talking with them. You have interpreters, you have the level of the questionnaire itself, and so on and so forth. So you use all of these tools to be able to finally dialogue with them. So that's what I can add. Thank you.
Okay, I will make a few quick points. First of all, regarding the divisions within the disability movement, it's true. But just like any other social movement, we are not one group, so inevitably there will be differences. But just because the women's movement isn't one united voice doesn't mean that we don't work with women. So I think that that's just something that we deal with and we move forward and we recognize the intricacies and the subtleties in the movement and its diversity. As for the differences between people who acquire disabilities as a result of their HIV positive status versus people with previous disabilities, I think that historically actually there was a large focus medically on the rehabilitation side of people living with AIDS and acquiring disability. So in a way it's been interesting to see disability seen more as a larger issue and not just as a rehabilitation issue. But I think that if we focus on disability as a social issue, as a social construction, then that will benefit everyone regardless of how the disability is acquired.
Okay, I'm really sorry, but we're not going to have time to take any more questions. So I hope that you will be able to come up and speak with our panelists, because we do have to stick to the time. And I would also like to thank our panelists, because they were extremely disciplined and stayed within their time period and were very respectful to one another, and I really admire that. I just want to add one more thing about cognitively disabled people. I was working at the Royal Tropical Institute for many years on a newsletter called Sexual Health Exchange, and already 12 years ago, we published an issue on HIV and disability, and we featured several programs that had developed materials for educating cognitively disabled people about HIV. And so if you write to the Royal Tropical Institute in Amsterdam, if you Google it, you can find it. You could get a copy of that issue, because the information is still very relevant. And now I will turn it over to Martin to conclude our session. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Maria. I just want to start by apologizing to our interpreters today. According to the interpretation law and ethics, they are supposed to rest every 45 minutes of interpretation. But as you can imagine, we've reused them for 1-2 hours full. Please, can we give them a very big clap? And I now want to put on a different dress and become a disability advocate, and just say this to all of you here today. I want to thank all of you for coming and just say the following. As disabled persons, we are unable not because of our disability. We are unable because of the major deficiencies in addressing our issues and needs vis-a-vis HIV/AIDS. We are unable because the environment disables us. We are unable because our disability is presumed more visible than our humanness. We are unable because you consciously and unconsciously disregard us. We demand that you place our humanness above our disability. We demand that you start perceiving disability as a human rights issue. By doing this, persons with disability will be accorded what every other human being aspires to, and that is dignity. I thank you very much.